Hey guys, Melissa here. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call the Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast. If I had to choose a descriptor for our family, it would be outside the box. Whether it's adopting three unrelated adolescents out of birth order, or trying to run a coffee shop in our quote-unquote spare time right after adopting, we love adventure. We had to give up that coffee shop, and our three oldest kids are launched for now. But with lots of extended family living at home and a full-time wellness business, there still aren't many dull moments. We've met so many amazing people with fascinating stories along our journey. I'd love to introduce them to you. Welcome to episode 4. As I mentioned last week, I got to chat with Dr. Chris Kittle, who co-authored what I think will become the definitive resource on older child adoption for those families who jump in with kids 10 or older. It's called Wisdom from Adoptive Families: Joys and Challenges in Older Child Adoption. You'll hear about what she learned from over 40 adoptive families who are generous and brave enough to share their experiences to help others. The book covers everything from sleep to abuse to expectations and everything in between. I'm in the middle of reviewing this book now and so wish I had had it 6 years ago when we were starting our older child adoption journey. Let's get started. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So Chris and I first crossed paths, at least this is my first memory, is you were doing research for a book that we're going to talk a little bit about today. And I probably responded to a survey or somehow caught wind and was able to be interviewed as part of your book project. And so I think that was our first point of contact. Do you remember?
I don't remember. That's how I remember it. Yes.
So, and then somehow we continue to be connected. I think probably because there just aren't 100 million people in the world who have adopted older kids, which is what your book is about. And when you find one and you find that you're on the same page about things or have had similar experiences, the adoption world is pretty small and pretty connected, even across geographic boundaries and limitations. So, yeah. And thanks to social media.
Yes.
We were able to stay
connected.
Aren't
we glad for social media? It's way better than the Yahoo groups we used to have years ago.
Right, exactly. Can you tell us a little bit about what your doctor stands for, what your PhD is in, and kind of what you were doing before?
My PhD is in higher education. So before becoming a mom, I worked in university administration in a couple of different private schools here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Decided I just really felt like the Lord wanted me to get a PhD for whatever was next and didn't know what that whatever was. But then after we adopted our oldest teenager from China, I knew that I was to write a book about older child adoption.
Which I'm so glad, because I think probably the reason you decided to do that is you were probably looking for one when you adopted this older child and you couldn't find one.
Absolutely. You know, and in the journey of writing the book, I've read most of the books that are out there on older child adoption or identify themselves affiliated with older child adoption in some way. And what I found is that most of them count older child adoption start at age 3. And so the experiences of someone who brings home a 3-year-old and the experience of someone like myself who brings home a 13-year-old is very, very different. And so while there are helpful things in many of those books on older child adoption, they weren't real helpful to me and our parenting challenges and journey because it was more for younger children than it is for older children. And so when we decided to write this book, or when I began the journey to write this book and then invited Dr. Kelly Reed to join me on that, it was really more about wanting to focus on the families who adopt older children, who adopt preteens and teens, because the journey is different, because the experiences are different and the challenges are different.
Amen. Our first adoption was a 2.5-year-old. So in some circles, like you said, that is considered a little bit older child. He wasn't an infant. But then our next adoptions were boom, 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 pretty much considered one adoption. And they were 13, 14, and 15-year-old, 12, why can't I remember? This is awful. 11, 13, and 14. They were 11, 13, and 14 when they all came home, unrelated.
Yeah.
And so that's like the age group that you were talking about and that your oldest adoption is from.
Yes, the research itself we gathered was from families who adopted a kid that was at least 10. And so some of these families, there was a sibling group, And there might have been a kid that was at least 10 in the group. And so we interviewed the parents about the children that were 10 or over, but we didn't include the younger children. That's who we focused on in our particular study.
Perfect. I love it. So tell me a little bit about your family makeup. So we know for sure that you adopted an older child from China. Is she your only adoption, or do you have others?
She's not. We adopted out of birth order. We adopted an 11-month-old from China, and in 2008, we brought her home. And then in 2010, we began the journey to adopt an older child or a child that was aging out. We made that decision because we felt like our youngest would do better if she stayed the baby, and we felt like that's what God called us to do. So we went into it at a time that was very, very busy. I was teaching and parenting a toddler or preschooler, I guess she would have been. And I was trying to finish my dissertation, and we were trying to fundraise. It's like everything happened at one time. But God really brought it all together, and we were able to bring her home then in 2011. So we adopted out of birth order. Our agency was okay with that. Our agency had us talk to other families who had adopted older kids. Seeing it now from where I sit now and having researched all of this and have talked to all these families, I see that it was great that they had us talk to other families who adopted older kids. The problem, I think, was that the families that they picked had been home less than 1 year. And while they did have some challenges, from our research, based upon the families in our study, which we had 40 families, most of the families found year two and year three to be the year where the worst, if you will, or the hardest part came in. And for some, that was maybe the hardest on how to attach and connect with your kid. For some, it was the kid finally becoming comfortable to where they acted like their true selves. And also for others, it was also a time when they shared some of their worst and hardest experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting looking back. I can say years two and three were for sure our hardest. Maybe years two, three, and four.
That's fascinating. So many families stated the same thing, and they didn't necessarily... I don't know that they necessarily realized that it was between years two and three, but when we looked at it all side by side and were able to look at all the interviews and all the surveys side by side, we could see that year two and three is when the majority of stuff had happened. So we had some families who'd only been home around a year, and so some of our research, we noted in the book that there are, you know, more things could have happened, more of these children could have been abused, and the parents just were not aware of it because they hadn't been home long enough.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when were you doing interviews for the book? Because now I'm wondering, we may have been one of those families that hadn't been home as long.
We had interviews in 2013, 2014.
Okay, so we came home in August 2012 with all three of ours. So we were kind of in that like year and a half time frame probably. And things definitely got worse before they got better. Now, in our case, because our kids were so old, they're in a position where they're able to be in situations outside of our house. So mm-hmm. That's kind of a no-brainer, right? Things got easier, not mm-hmm. easy, but easier once mm-hmm. they weren't living under our roof anymore. So that obviously plays a role. And so that kind of skews our like years yeah. four to five for sure. But that's true for a lot of families, though. If they bring home kids who are 13, 14, 15, you know, and that's interesting because I wonder how we would have perceived that season if we had known like people that had been home for 10 years, like we're able to look back and be like, oh, if you could just get over that like 2 to 3 year hump, you know, it might get better. But there just isn't a lot of experience, and most families who have brought kids home that old haven't been home much longer than 4 or 5 years. I've run into very, very few people who adopted past the age of 10 who have been home longer than we have. I mean,
we were fortunate
more than like
to find,
6 months or something.
I think we probably found 5 or so families, maybe a few more than that, who had been home way more than 5 years, some of which had been home closer to 10 and 12 years. So it was good for us to be able to incorporate those experiences in our book as well. And we have a particular chapter that looks just at preparing your kids for adulthood. So we incorporated ideas that families had were doing at that time or had done to help their kid prepare for adulthood. And then we were able to look at those who had already moved into adulthood and maybe had been out of the house for 1, 4, 5 years and see kind of how they were doing. And their parents were able to tell us how they felt their kids were doing as far as having transitioned into adulthood. So that was great that we had that information. So that kind of helps those of us who aren't that far in the journey to be able to say, okay, well, this is what could happen. And this, you know, is how it works for these children. Doesn't mean it's going to work that way for mine, but it gives me an idea of possibly what to expect.
Yeah, were you, as you were talking to these families, like, besides the fact that you're doing research for a book that you're going to publish and help other people, this was really real for you in the moment with your daughter?
It absolutely was. And not only in the interviewing part was it so real, but just even then getting into the transcriptions and digging into the interviews and doing the coding and then putting it all together and then figuring out what needed to go in the book, what was potentially the most important things to go in the book, because there was literally over 100 hours of just interviews. And it was a lot. We have lots of information, some of which is very common throughout, but not all of it. So being able to know what part that aren't as common to include was sort of challenging.
Yeah, for sure. So what was your intended audience? Was your audience people that are thinking about adopting older children, people that are already kind of in the trenches with it, or kind of a mix of both?
Kind of a mix of both. And Kelly wanted us to make sure that we also focus on the professionals, because a lot of professionals aren't aware of adoption, and other professionals who are aware of adoption are not aware of the specific challenges of older child adoption. I know when we called our agency, we hadn't been home for very long, probably the first 2 months or so, and I called and I said, hey, we are struggling in this area. How can we address this? Or what help do you have for me? And they pointed me back to my social worker, who was in her mid-20s herself and had no idea anything to do with older child adoption. She mostly focused on infant adoption. So she really had no resources to help us in any way. So it was very, very frustrating for us. And so this book, we are wanting this book to help those who are currently parenting their child that they have made the decision to adopt. And we also wrote it for those who are considering older child adoption, because I believe that there are a lot of people who choose to adopt an older child because they want to save a child, because they've heard that the kids need homes and they can provide a home, they have an extra room, whatever, and not necessarily because they realize the cost involved for them and for their family. And it's not simply like having an exchange student at your house. It's way bigger than that. And so those are the families that we want to be able to read the book and decide, you know what, I'm not so sure that we can handle this. I'm not so sure that we have the resources to be able to put our child in therapy multiple times a month. I'm not sure that we are able to handle this type of stress or these behaviors or these medical needs, whatever they may be. And so we're hoping that families who might otherwise disrupt or find a new family for their child will decide before they even begin the journey that this is perhaps not the best road for them.
Yeah, I love that. When you talk about costs, there's financial costs, and then there's a lot of other non-monetary costs involved. So in hindsight, looking back, what are some of those costs that no one told you to figure in? I have my laundry list in my head, but I would love to know what you're thinking. You would tell another family.
You know, one of the moms very wisely told me this when I interviewed her. And at the time, it meant a lot to me. And at the time, and since then, I've thought more about it. And I thought, man, I wish somebody would have told me this beforehand. And that is, there is nothing that prepares you as a parent on how you will feel or how you will respond when your new child in some way mistreats your existing child or children. And I thought that was so insightful, because you are, as parent, needing to love and care for both of these children, but you've had one or two or three children longer than you've had your new child, and your new child is the one that's bullying or mistreating or injuring an existing child, and it's a very difficult place to be in. There's not anything that can prepare you for or how you will respond or how you will feel. And I wish I would have known that before. I think another cost is just the cost on, as one mom put it, she had biological children and then adopted a couple older children. And she said, I never realized that the family unity that we had would be gone. And she, that was a cost she did not anticipate. I think there were also, you know, spiritual costs as you're praying for your children and just not sure how to meet their needs and not sure how to respond to them and how to teach them and how to love them.
Yeah. What about, did you do any questioning about marriages and older kid adoption? I know marriage is kind of almost like a whole other book, but were there any research? Was there any research on that part?
You know, we did not specifically ask about how the older child adoption impacted the marriage. We do, however, in our book, have a section on helping families, helping parents being able to make sure that they connect with each other, that they have opportunities and they take opportunities, and how it can impact the marriage relationship.
Yeah, and it actually all comes back, this is really awful, but it comes back to money, dollars and cents in a lot of ways, all of the costs, not that you can monetize them all, but I know when I talk to other families and we talk about, you know, you need date nights, you need self-care for mom, and then we talk about the professionals that we need to help our kids kind of work through all of their history. All of that has a monetary cost. And I remember thinking our agency should have like forced us to have a trust fund of like tens of thousands of dollars, probably per child. And it would have sounded ludicrous at the time, especially when, you know, you talked about fundraising for your own adoption and adoption is costly, just the process to bring a child home, especially international adoption. And I would have thought it was ridiculous. I know I would have probably fought it hand and foot because I didn't know what I didn't know.
Not necessarily having a trust fund, but just making you aware that your child is going to need therapy, that your child might need speech, your child might have undiagnosed medical conditions, your child might need some sort of surgeries that you are not aware of. You know, their teeth might be falling out of their head and they need lots of dental work. Lots of things that I think, and I don't want to put all the blame on agencies, but I think that they don't do as good of a job preparing families. They focus on getting the children in families, which is a great focus. But they don't follow that up and make sure that these families are ready and prepared and able to truly care for these children and give them a better life.
Yeah,
and
I think
that agencies will read the book. And really, I'm also hoping that agencies, not only will the social workers read the book, but I'm also hoping that they use it as required education resources for the families who want to adopt an older child. Because I think it could cut off at the pass a lot of problems if families know this. I mean, I think one lady messaged me yesterday and she said, I went into older child adoption with such an Annie mentality. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty much how we all go into it, really, if you think about it. Because there's not a whole lot of pulling us back to earth and say the reality is this and this and this. The reality is that this is going to be hard. The reality is there's going to be a lot of medical things that you're going to have to address.
Right. And the reality is insurance, at least in our experience, we search high and low for, especially in the mental health field, professionals and counselors and therapists that we really thought would serve our kids well and that fit our family values and our parenting models and all of these things. And I can tell you from experience working with other families too, none of those people take insurance. They're all out-of-pocket people.
Yep.
And even some of those medical things, some of it's weird medical or you want to find an alternative treatment or a more holistic treatment or something. And I can tell you for years, we lived off of the out-of-network part of our insurance plan. Like, I don't think we ever saw anyone in-network for a long time. And I saw someone post on a Facebook group recently, you know, someone was talking about this, counting the cost. And she said, well, insurance will cover whatever your kid needs when they come home.
Not exactly.
And I thought, I mean, it's a nice idea, but there's just needs that just don't fall under the purview of what insurance was meant to do or what the law allows insurance to do or what insurance is willing to do. And so I think I naively thought thoughts like that before we did this, like, oh, well, if my kid needs that, like, surely someone's going to cover it or there will be a service or at least someone will know where to point us, even if I have to pay for it. And I think your experience with contacting your agency, we did a similar thing. And there just wasn't a lot of resources. I was just shocked at the lack of even ability to point me in a direction to get me started for where to look for resources. So I'm super excited that you guys have that vision to think about the professionals and services for the kids and the families and all of those challenges and how that's such a huge part, because I don't know a single family who has brought home an older child who hasn't needed services in some form, whether it be medical or mental health.
Well, and you know, one of the moms said her social worker, who obviously really knew her stuff, told her that, you know, 100% of these kids have been abused in some way and are going to need therapy. Like, that is a given. You have to know that before you even bring your kid home. And I thought that was great that they said that. I don't know if my social worker would have told me that, I would have probably said, okay, that's fine, we have insurance. I don't know what I would have said, but I don't think it would have caused me to spend as much time contemplating what the cost of that would be as perhaps it should have.
Right. And I think that a lot. I think agencies should be doing this, or people should be talking about that. And I think I was pretty bullheaded and pretty stubborn and pretty dead set on the fact that we had been called to older child adoption. And I know hindsight's 2020, but as much as I think there's room for agencies to grow in what they can offer families post-placement and then what they're doing to prepare families. So I definitely don't want to take any of that off the table, because I'm a huge advocate for that. But I also think we would have been a pain in the butt to educate or convince or even to have open ears to hear some of the stories, because I think we would have heard them and then just convinced ourselves that's not going to happen to us. It's like, you know, the 20-year-old without the full frontal lobe. It's like, you know, I can go ride without a helmet, or I can go drive without a seatbelt on. Like, nothing's going to happen to me. And I think we probably had that mentality, and we had a lot of energy, and we were wide-eyed and bushy-tailed about what we thought we could do, for sure. But now I know. And I think that's where I wish agencies were stronger on the post-placement support, because that's the side where I feel like you probably can't talk a family out of their calling. And if it's really their calling, we shouldn't talk them out of it.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And I think there are some agencies that do a very good job on post-placement. The agency and the partner agency that we use when we brought our youngest daughter home is excellent at post-placement. And I visited with both of them before we finished this book about different aspects. And specifically about rehoming and finding a new family for your child, because this is something that they're passionate about and they want to help before you get to that point, before, as one of them put, before it's too far gone. And I don't think most agencies, and I don't blame them from a business perspective. You know, they have to look at bringing money in, and you do that by getting new families to adopt children. And post-placement probably doesn't bring in as much money, particularly if you just make it as part of the package, if you will, part of the upfront fees that you pay. So you're not going to be getting regular income through those post-placement follow-up things. But maybe you could, and it just kind of depends upon the focus of the agency, I think.
Yeah, for sure. There's so many moving parts and things to consider.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a dicey subject, but when you think about some of the families you talk to, or maybe your daughter's situation, has it changed your perspective on, or your, where you place the value of family, especially for older kids? I just have watched our older kids struggle from a cultural perspective, and for no fault of their own, but it's stinking hard to change cultures when you're a teenager. Mm-hmm. I mean, for anybody. And that's a huge cost. You know, we talked about cost for the family, but a huge cost for the kids. And I know that our kids, when we met them and when they were still in Ethiopia, they wanted a family. They wanted to be adopted. But they had no idea what that meant. Just like we wanted to be that family for them, but we had no idea what that meant. And it's really made us really roll around and contemplate and mull on this idea, you know, in a situation where if they could have been supported by a stable adult, someone who was a constant in their lives and stayed in their birth country, you know, does having a kind of quote unquote nuclear family, or, you know, a family in general, kind of trump that? And, you know, once you're 13, is the cost too high to try to move across an ocean and adapt to something so drastically new? Have you guys kind of thought about that as you've parented your older kids?
I have not thought about that because, you know, kids adopted from China, there is no stable adult. It is orphanage, which isn't at all like family. And then once you age out of the orphanage, then it's you're on your own. So I haven't really thought of it that way. I remember one year we were in the midst of writing. So within the last 2 years or so, I was teaching. I teach leadership communication at a local private university here, and I was teaching, we were talking specifically about information processing and the study of information processing and how your brain processes information. And it was very fascinating to me. In that moment, something clicked, and I realized that my daughter did not have a schema for family. And part of information processing is you have a schema or a reference, a point of reference for how you lead, or in this case, how you view family or how you view parents. I personally, because I'm a very visual person, see it as boxes. In our memories, we have a box that says what a leader looks like, and you look in the box, and it has things that you learned and personal leadership that you've experienced or that you've witnessed. And so for my daughter, for parent, she looked in the box of parent, and it was completely empty. There was not one thing in there because she had no idea what the role of parent was.
Or it was filled with something wrong, like that didn't belong in the box.
Well, and she had a very skewed version of what teacher box looked like, because teacher box taught things that parents taught. And I remember our first year or so home, her talking about her not wanting me to work with her teacher certain things. She wanted her teachers at school to do that. And us having this conversation of, well, that's not what teachers at school teach in America. Teachers at school teach the academic content that they're responsible to teach. They don't teach how to cook, or they don't teach manners at the table, or they don't teach whatever that might be that parents teach. And that was completely foreign to her. And it didn't make sense to her. Why doesn't the teacher do that? That's what they did in China. That's how I learned things. And so it was this huge light bulb moment for me that she doesn't know what parent or family looks like. And so I think many kids come and they think they maybe have a TV version of what parents look like, or they have some other misconstrued idea of what parents look like, and then they come home and they're in a family and they see parents and you're like, well, time out, this is not what parents are supposed to look like. When I look in my box of parents because of the TV shows I've been watching or the books that I read or what people told me, this doesn't match up. This isn't right. Something's not right. And so it creates this great dissonance that is difficult for them. And then you add into, you were talking about the cultural piece, which I think is very much tied into identity, and them trying to figure out who am I, which is something that you are faced with when you are a teen anyway, figuring out who you are. And then you add onto the piece of, this is who I was in China, or this is who I was in Ethiopia, or this is who I was in Russia, but that's not where you are anymore. It adds an additional complex layer. So I think I've told my daughter, and I believe this is true, my personal belief is this is true of every child who chooses to be adopted older and has to make a verbal decision to adopt, to be adopted, that they are the bravest people. I mean, my daughter came, she was willing to go with a tall blonde lady who doesn't even speak her language. She was willing to go with her and then get on a plane with her and fly to a different part, not completely knowing what all was going on. I mean, how much more brave could you be moving to a different part of China that you had never experienced before, spend a couple of days there or a week there, and then get on a plane and fly all the way to a completely different country? And I just feel like that is so brave, and they don't really know what they're getting into, no different than we know what we're getting into.
Yeah, for sure. That echoes so much of what our experience was. And I even remember at the airport, we had two of our kids that we brought home on one trip, and we got to the airport and there was an escalator and they're looking at us and we're like, you know, get on. And they looked at us, and it just occurred to me, I was like, they've never seen an escalator before, let alone ride one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they just were dumbfounded. They had no idea what it was, and then no idea what to even do about it. And, right. you know, so here we are with like all this luggage and we're trying to get these two like teenagers to ride an escalator for the first time. I mean, it's kind of comical, but it's so representative of, I mean, that was just one little thing. And that was even before we even stepped out of their city.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we landed in LAX, we had to hurry. We had a very fairly short time to get through customs and INS and everything and then get over and catch our flight home. And she was walking so slow because she was just looking around. And I realized in that moment it was the first time that she had been someplace where people had different color hair and people had different color skin. And they weren't all basically the same. They didn't all have the same skin color, all pretty much had the same hair color. It was the first time, and she just was completely overwhelmed by that and just couldn't hardly take it in. It was just so much.
Yeah. It's getting into that space that reminds me to have compassion for our kids, even when it's really hard. But sometimes it's maddening because we've also had those same conversations about what's in your parenting or mom box. Mm-hmm. Almost just like your daughter. It's funny, you know, our kiddos are from Ethiopia, so totally different culture, totally different. Mm-hmm. But it's that same idea. And our kids had boxes for at least mom and other caring adults and stable adults. They hadn't been in institution life for all of their life. And they remembered parts of their life that didn't exist there. But there was still, it's funny how you adapt so quickly and you kind of forget things, or just culturally they were different. And we did have a similar conversation, actually a lot of similar conversations, where I would give an advice or give a directive and the line back would be like, you're not my preacher, you're not my teacher, you're not my doctor, you're not my whatever. And as you're talking about the box, I'm thinking our kids, that box of mom was all the things that they didn't have.
Right.
Where they were from and in their experience. And so they did have teachers and they did have interactions with church leaders and pastors and doctors, but they didn't have someone to just give them all the wants instead of the needs. Mm-hmm. And so we had this really telling conversation a good year after our kids came home. So, I mean, we had been living in a lot of chaos for a year already, but I was telling my son no about something, and a different kid, not even the kid that I'm telling no, is standing in the kitchen looking at me with her head cocked, and she goes, why don't you just do it for him? Like, why? And I said, well, you know, there was a list of reasons for why, you know, this wasn't going to happen. And she said, but isn't that your job? And I said, well, what do you mean? And she goes, isn't your job, your mom, isn't your job just to give us what we want, like what we ask for? Like, and I thought, oh gosh, like, cause clearly I'm not allowed to give health advice or spiritual advice or all of those things. So I've already been told I'm not the teacher. I'm not all of these other things. And so it left me with, well, since I'm not allowed to do any of those things, like what I'm allowed to do is fill all the wishes. Like that's what's left in the mom box. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, this explains so much. Like, this is why I said, this is why we're having issues, you know, like your definition of mom and my definition of mom are different. And we've been, you know, banging heads about that for a while. And we continue to bang heads about that because your paradigm about the world is so shaped by the time you're 13 or 14. And it takes a long time. I mean, it may never fully shift to what, I mean, it's never going to obviously shift to what my paradigm is. But I just think that like that light bulb moment of, we take our paradigm for granted, even though we know in our heads, like other people have different experiences and we know that other paradigms exist, until you live with a different paradigm, like day in and day out and rub up against that different paradigm, you don't really realize like how different paradigms come and how different they are.
You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we had several families that had also adopted from the United States. And so these kids come with having perhaps multiple placements and multiple people that they call mom and multiple people that they've called dad. And so they don't really know, they don't understand the permanence of adoption because that hasn't been what they've experienced. So there's that part too. And at each of those moms that they've experienced probably parented very different. And so then how do you parent and what is a mom supposed to be and how are they supposed to act and what are the things that they're supposed to do or supposed to help you with is unclear to them because they've had so many different experiences. They're not really sure which one is the one that they're living right now.
Yeah, for sure. And I know from connecting with other parents who have brought kids home domestically or through the foster care system, that's a whole, there is like a whole nother layer where we were battling this cultural, you know, language barrier, and we homeschooled for a little while. So there's even this opportunity to kind of create a sense of American culture that we wanted to have them experience first before they got out and experience all different other types of pieces of culture. Mm-hmm. And the social piece was really different because they obviously knew no one when they came, and
right.
the social media that they had and the people they were connecting to were other kids, either still in their orphanages, or we actually had a whole slew of kids come home that same summer. So they would connect with other kids from Ethiopia who had been adopted into other states. And whereas, you know, kids who have been around the block a couple times in the States through foster care, you know, they came with all these friends and connections and ways to, you know, sneak out and, you know, reintegrate into other areas and birth family and other things, you know, right down the street or in a region or a bus ride away or, you know, texts from people or, you know, random visitors from school and all these things that we didn't have to battle with because our kids were fairly isolated within their first year. But, you know, I hear stories from other families that have kiddos that are very American, and they're just battling that difference of culture between, you know, all the different cultures of their foster families and birth family and all of those other things. And it's like a whole, there's, you know, probably like could be a whole chapter on, you know, navigating those challenges.
Yeah, but, you know, surprisingly, I think probably the biggest thing that surprised me in doing this book was there were more similarities regardless of where you adopted from than differences. So, I mean, we had 7 different countries that were represented in our study. So we had China and the United States, we had Ethiopia, Colombia, Russia, Hungary, and Sierra Leone. And surprising, I was really shocked that there were as many similarities as far as struggles, as many similarities as far as behaviors and in challenges, regardless of the country that you adopted from. I guess I expected it on some level, but not to the level that we saw. I just did not expect that.
That's interesting. There's this weird paradox, I think, in hurt kids. They all have their own story, and there's really no one-size-fits-all solution. You know, what worked for one of our kids, like, never worked for the other one, and it never worked for longer than 2 weeks or whatever. You know, you're always on your toes. You're always reinventing the wheel. But then at the same time, I work with a lot of families, and I talk to a lot of moms, and a lot of times conversations start off with, so I don't know how to tell you this, or this is really embarrassing, or I'm not sure if you've ever experienced this before or heard of this. And then, you know, they mention a bizarre behavior, and mm-hmm. without a doubt, like every time, either we've had it in our house because we've had a lot of crazy in our house, or mm-hmm. I've talked to someone else who's had that. And so while they're all so different and they respond so differently to different things, at the same time, like they kind of all read from the same playbook somehow, you know, across cultures and all those things. There's something about, like, you know, a person from a hard place or a hurt person who, however we're wired or something, that it is fascinating to me again and again how so many of the challenges and behaviors seem to repeat themselves.
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting about that is that we as adoptive parents will connect, but how often do we share about those weird, random things? Unfortunately, not enough, because otherwise we wouldn't all feel so alone in what we are experiencing.
I totally agree with you. And one of our mission, at least my mission, I'm an oversharer for sure, is to be a person who is really open with what we've experienced, because I want people to feel like they're not alone. But it's a weird line to walk, because I, like I said, I'm an oversharer, so I haven't walked this line very well. But, you know, I know at the same time, it's their story. A lot of what
Absolutely.
Is my story is their story. And so I think that's why that this has been such a hard base to heal in and get connected in, because you don't want to throw your kid under the bus. Well, I
Absolutely.
Mean, some days you kind of want to,
well,
but
sure.
in the end, like our heads,
right.
in our heads, and we know, and we don't want them to be judged for their behaviors, mm-hmm. especially in circles where people don't understand
yes.
and don't understand the trauma and what, you know, that there is a real self, a real, you know, a hurt kid, and the behaviors are just a really unfortunate manifestation of a lot of horrible things. But you do want to kind of scream it from the rooftops and be like, this is hard. And You want to gather other people who get it with you. And it's hard to find those people without standing on a mountaintop and being like, okay, we're one of those people who has that really bizarre behavior, you know?
Right. And that's, you know, one of the things, our families in our study were all very open and shared a lot of very valuable information. And we have been very careful to make sure, I mean, every single family has a pseudonym. And even in places that I felt, even up until we got ready to send the manuscript in, there were changes that I made, on, and I talked to Kelly about that. I was concerned about wanting to make sure that nobody could identify themselves. And they may be able to identify themselves, or maybe I should say that nobody who knows them would necessarily be able to identify them, particularly in the hard stuff. So on our chapter on abuse, where we cover the various different types of abuse, and we incorporate some of the stories that families share that their children experience, we don't have any name in that chapter at all. And I wanted to make sure that no parent, and Kelly did too, wanted to make sure that no parent felt like they were out in the open, that they had said too much, or even that if at some point their child might pick up the book, that they would be able to identify themselves. And the part, we have another chapter about loving your child, because many parents in our study really struggle to feel love and to love their child. And so we made sure that anything that would appear as though someone doesn't feel love for their child, we made sure that there were no names attached, so that if at any point the child perhaps picks up the book, or somebody that knows them picks up the book, they would not be able to identify that very sensitive, hard, difficult, challenging stuff about the people that they know. And I think part of the reason why families were so willing to share their experience was because it was one-on-one, them just talking to me or to Kelly, but also because they knew that we were going to make sure that they would not be identified and that their story would be as anonymous as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And I think it's going to be such a great tool. Even, you know, your intended audience was certainly, like we talked about, professionals, parents, mm-hmm. and, you know, prospective families. But do you think it has enough story in it where you could hand it to maybe a friend who doesn't get it, like kind of outside that circle of safety, to say, like, this is an example of what families are walking who have older kids, so that you don't have to out your own kids, but you can give people a picture of kind of what that is? Or do you think that there's, I don't know. Like, do you think that would be a good idea? You know who's safe to tell these things to.
Yes, we did also include one particular chapter. It's called External Support. And it's a lot of it focuses on you as the parent making sure that you have support lined up and how to gain that support in the midst of your troubles and helping you cope through this new family. We also incorporated in our appendix, we have, I think it's maybe 2 or 3 pages, that specifically can be given to people in our lives that tells them the basics, such as our child is our real child and we are their real parents, and tells them what not to say, such as don't tell us some horrific adoption story that you heard from somebody, from somebody, from somebody, because that doesn't help us in any way. To things that we need you to do after we bring our child home. You know, we want you to acknowledge our child. We want you to give our child gifts or a card or a welcome home sign, something to show that you care about our child, just like you would if our child was an infant. And we do need you to help us when we first come home, and help us by bringing meals, help us by helping us do chores, help us by doing our lawn, those sort of things. So we wanted to make sure that families had a part of the book that they could give to people in their life that they love, or friends, some sort of surrounding neighbors, whatever, that could help them to know how to help us as parents, particularly when we first come home, because I think that's where the newness of it and families not really knowing how to ask for help, people not really knowing how to help, just to provide that help for them.
Yeah, so maybe like the first 6 weeks, and then what did you say, like years 2 and 3?
Yeah.
Circle back and get that meal rotation going somewhere around like year 2.5.
Right. Well, and you know, the whole book is really written. I mean, it's a research book, and I think we tried to make it as easy to read for the common person as it is easy to read and informative for the professional who would be wanting to know more the meats and potatoes of who are these people we talk to and how did we design our study and all of that kind of stuff that the regular parent probably doesn't really care about.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like it isn't necessarily one of those books that you'll like sit down and read cover to cover. I mean, some people really will, but it's also one of those things that you can have on your shelf and you'll pull it out and look at a chapter or, you know, give it to someone with a certain chapter earmarked or those kinds of things where you don't have to read cover to cover. You know, you might just tag something for a teacher or a professional.
Yes, each chapter focuses on a different topic. So if you just needed help about education, how do you address these issues or what issues might we experience, then you can just go to the education chapter. Or if you are wanting to know how do we as a family adjust, how can we create better connection within our family, then you can go to that chapter and look at those different ideas and read through that part. So we really organized it such that will help you more from a topical perspective and it not just being individual family stories, but more from a topical perspective.
Yeah, I love that. So what would you say has been your biggest, I mean, we talked a little bit about this, but what would you say has been your biggest takeaway from this journey, the book journey and or the parenting journey, because you kind of have been doing both in parallel for a while now.
I think from the book, I've learned more from the book than in the parenting journey. And I think from the book, it has helped me realize that in older child adoption, everything, and in a lot of ways, I truly do mean everything, is a mix of your child realizing that your child can't do something or won't do something. And this is something that when I've seen, as I've read all of these stories and as I've listened to these families and as I've been writing this book, I have seen this over and over. And as I reflect on my own parenting journey and my own child, I feel the same is true. They can't learn this or they won't learn this. They can't do this or they won't do this. And it's a sitting in an area where it's not clear. It's really not clear. And I think in a lot of ways for the kids, I have realized it's not clear to the kids whether they can't or whether they won't. And it's difficult for them to even be in the place to feel like they should or having that pressure, whether it's from parents, whether it's from friends, or whether it's from work, or from teachers that they should do something, but for some reason they are unable to do that. And this is where I think therapy becomes so important, particularly with a therapist who knows something about older child adoption, to be able to help their child work through that so that they aren't stuck, but that they can move forward into whatever it is that they need to do next or whatever area they need to move in, whatever area they need to grow in.
Okay. So I'm going to jump in now to say that I tried to squeeze everything we talked about into one episode. But the fact is that after I thought I was going to wrap up, we kept chatting for the length of another entire episode. So join us next week for part two, where we chat about trust and how Chris's daughter is doing now and whether or not she has another book up her sleeve and so much more. Have you adopted an older child? I'd love to connect with you on Instagram or Twitter. You can find me at M.A. Corkum. I'll have all the places where you can find Dr. Kittle at the end of our next week's show. In the meantime, I hope you'll leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Constructive criticism and suggestions are as welcome as the positives. Thanks so much for listening.